Welcome. This is the first time we're using this room. This is a great opportunity for us to open this room to a nice crowd of people. I understand that some of you are from the Franklin Simpson High School. Yes. If you are, can you raise your hands?
Seniors.
Seniors from Franklin Simpson High School. Well, welcome. You're a senior. How about everybody else?
There's only a select few, but I'm there.
Okay. We're delighted to have you here, and we hope you'll enjoy being on campus today and taking in what you can, including a program. I'm Mike Bender. I'm Dean of Libraries at Western. I want to thank all of you for coming. As I mentioned, this is the first use of this room. It's called the Leisure Reading Room. We're going to be using it for programs such as this and also for exhibits. We're now in the midst of developing the first exhibit. It's a traveling one. It comes from the Tennessee Holocaust Commission, and it's about the survivors of the Holocaust. And this is a partnership that brings you this program today. It's one of the libraries at Western, the public library in Bowling Green, and Barnes & Noble. We also do the Southern Kentucky Book Fest and some other activities throughout the year to encourage reading and the love of books. This program is called Black History Month at Your Library, and it's in its third year. It celebrates each year a Kentucky African American author. And I'm going to leave the introduction of the author to Lou Ann Crowther, who is a professor at Western in the English department. She's actually an associate professor, but she's on her way to becoming a full professor. And I want to tell you a few things about Lou Ann before she introduces our speaker. She's been at Western over 20 years. She teaches a variety of composition and courses about writing. She's a teacher, she's a researcher, and she's a writer. And she also loves poetry. And particularly since our author is a poet, she's particularly happy to talk about our speaker, and I'd like to ask to come to the podium, Dr. Lou Ann Crowther.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bender. Can you hear me? Glad to see so many of you here today. Glad to see some of my present and former students here today as well. It's an honor and privilege for me to introduce Frank X. Walker. I met him a couple of years ago when he was here to read poetry, and bought both of his books then. I bought another one of his books last night when he read at the public library, and I really enjoy his poetry. He's a native of Danville, Kentucky, and he now lives in Lexington, Kentucky. He is a graduate of the University of Kentucky and Spalding University. He is the author of three collections of poetry. The latest one, which is for sale on the table in the back, is called Black Box. It was published in 2005. His second work, Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York, was published in 2003. And it's about York, the African-American man who accompanied Lewis and Clark on their travels. This book won him the Lillian Smith Book Award in 2004. And that award is given to works about racial and social justice. The other book of poetry that he has published is called Afrolatcha. It was published in 2000, and that word is a term that he coined for the heritage of his African forefathers and the experiences of his Appalachian life. He has also received a very prestigious award recently. Last year, he won the Lannan Literary Award. That is an award given to writers and poets whose work reflects and challenges our understanding of the world. Mr. Walker teaches in the Department of English and Theater and is the interim director of the African American Studies Program at Eastern Kentucky University. I'd like to end this introduction with a quote by Mary Popham, who wrote an article about Black Box in the Courier Journal. She says of Mr. Walker's work, We share the memories stored in the black box of the young poet from Danville, who grew into a man of the world, a poet for all generations, Mr. Frank X. Walker.
How you guys doing? It's a good-looking crowd. So, is it Franklin Simpson High School?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Is that sounding right back there? It's a lot of microphones up here. So I'm a little nervous. Too many mics. I'm not sure how you feel about poetry, or even if you like it at all. How many people are willing to admit that right now they don't particularly like poetry? Anybody brave enough to admit? Thank you. I appreciate your honesty. I'm going to ask you again at the end. You know, it's my goal to try to convert you. I think that part of why you don't like it currently may have more to do with what you think poetry is or what poetry has been for you your whole long lives, which seem to be very young. I imagine most of you probably average about 16 years old or younger, older, both. All right. He said, yes, real quick, so he must be like 29, 30. But I'm just gonna read poetry. I'm going to read some things that try to do a couple of things. One is tell you more about who I am and how I grew up and what I feel I'm close to, because those things are the things I write about. I'm going to talk to you also about my love and fascination for history. One of the things about being a fan of history and living in Kentucky is believing that things are connected. I imagine most of you have read or believe what you read about Kentucky history. I'm pretty sure it's incomplete. There's so many people who look like you that are a major part of our history that, you know, we should, you know, there should be streets named after all of them somewhere in the state. There should be buildings on every campus named after them. But we have a little ways to go in that area. So I'll talk a little bit about history and trying to be in Kentucky and be a black man and live with Kentucky's interesting historical past and make sense of it all. Talk about family. I'll talk about political issues. One of the things that's important to know about me is that I'm one of 10. My mother was one of 10. My father was one of 11. So that gives us a lot of people to talk about, you know. I have two kids of my own. I'm not going to try to make 10. You know, I think I couldn't afford it. You know, I couldn't buy that many cell phones. I know you guys or iPods. But at the end of this reading, I'm going to switch from, you know, the more personal poems to give you a brief history lesson as an exhibit of my commitment to history. And it's a story that I want you to leave here with. It has to do with, you guys have all heard of Lewis and Clark. But you may have never heard of York. So if I can keep from melting in the next 30 minutes or so. Anybody other than me hot in this room? All right. Well, you all won't mind if I take off my jacket. You won't be insulted. It's old. Don't worry about it. Any basketball fans? This might need to go down a bit when I start reading.
Okay.
The thing about basketball in this state is that some people think it's a religion. Any basketball players in the room? Any athletes in general? All right. The thing about being an athlete in Kentucky is sometimes you get sidetracked and people think that you're going to be the next Michael Jordan and stop investing in your intellectual development. So this poem is for all of you athletes and it's called Death by Basketball. All right, she heard that before. Well, I'm going to read it just to you. Okay. Before and after school, he stood on a milk crate, eyeballed the mirror, and only saw Wayne Turner at tournament time. A third grader just off the bus, barely 4 feet off the ground, he dropped his books, sank a J from the top of the key, and heard the crowd roar. Beat his man off the dribble with the breaking neck crossover and slammed himself on the cover of a box of Wheaties. He was out there every night under a street light, fighting through double picks, talking trash to imaginary body checks. You can't hold me, fool, fake right. This is my planet. Drive left. Is the camera on? Reverse layup. That's butter, baby. Finish from the tray from downtown. Swish! I'm in the zone tonight. Who got next? More than a little light in the ass. Hands so small, the ball almost dribbled him. He formed his own layup line in the bluegrass, wildcat jersey hanging like a summer dress on a court-made ball from daily use. And instead of writing his spelling words, he signed a contract he could barely read. Inked a commitment in big block letters to the NBA and Nike and Sprite. Scribbled superstar in cursive with a fat red pencil and practiced his million-dollar smile, not his multiplication table. Thinking of how many chocolate milks he could buy with his signing bonus or all-star game appearance fee after recess. Another shooting. Another tragic death. Another little genius who would never test out of a dream that kills legitimate futures every night under streetlights wherever these products are sold. You like that? Well, you can clap. You don't have to clap if you don't like it. But it's considered polite in poetry circles. The thing about that poem is, you know, Shakespeare didn't write any sonnets about basketball. And a lot of things that I write about have more to do with the subject matter I'm interested in. And I think it's important that young people know that you can do both. You know, if you're an outstanding scholar or athlete, you need to know who Paul Robeson is. You know that you can be both. There are examples of that all throughout history, probably in your own communities, neighborhoods, in your own households. But a lot of times people get sidetracked and think you only do one thing. You don't have to just be a scholar, or as my son would call it, a nerd or an athlete. Any hip hop fans in here? One or two? All right. This next poem is for you then. I know all you guys who know who Martin Luther King is. You can't have gotten through January without hearing about a celebration or reading about him or studying in class. The thing about Dr. King is his legacy is mostly grounded in the tradition of nonviolence. And everybody can appreciate what that means. I was teaching school in Alabama to a group of young adolescent males whose older siblings were either victims of violence because of gang violence or who had been in a domestic situation where they witnessed a lot of violence and they didn't understand nonviolence because violence was a reality. And they had an additional challenge trying to understand King's philosophy. They thought that if he really was as gifted as he was verbally, that he would not have been an activist. They think he would have been a rapper. So, this is my response to that. You guys all right over there? All right. You need some allergy medicine? Tissue or something? Okay, he's going to sneeze himself out. This is called Little King. What if the good Reverend Dr. M.L.K. Jr. was just Marty, or Little King? Not a pastor, but a little faster from the streets quoting gangster rap, not Gandhi. Was not Dr. King, but King Doctor, or Ice K. His peace sign on a gold tooth, a gleaming 14 karat light from around his neck. What if somebody screaming nigger hit him in the head with a brick and he pulled out a 9mm and squeezed off one or two rounds, not tears, praying only that he not miss? Sported MLK on fat brass knuckles and a left-handed diamond pinky ring. Walked the streets with his homeboys, spray painting, "Let Freedom Ring." And I had a dream on bus stops and stop signs. Got arrested for conspiring to incite riots, disturbing the peace, and resisting arrest. Didn't preach from no pulpit, but on a microphone, behind turntables, bixing and scratching, listening to Dr. Dre, Wu-Tang, and Notorious B.I.G. Pants down to his high tops, hat on backwards, eyes on a prize new voice, not no bill, no piece of nothing that just rings when it's hit, a voice that hits back. Could he still be king? What do you think? Could he?
Yeah.
Still be king. Absolutely. He could still be king. Now, is that what y'all are expecting? Y'all want me to read some Shakespeare and sonnets? Or you want
no.
Nothing against Shakespeare.
No.
All right, well, I'm glad you appreciate those. And you know, I think those are probably more representative of my politics. A lot of other poems are a reflection of my family. I mean, I'm going to go backwards and read a tribute poem to one of my relatives. Since there are people who've been here since yesterday, I'll read something different. This is a poem that I hope none of you have to deal with as a personal family issue. This is a tribute poem to my sister. It's called Rockstar. My sister loves rocks. She'll do anything for a piece of hard candy. My sister's a rock star. Passed her on the street, she didn't even see me through her tinted windows. My sister's a mountain. When I call up to her, my I love yous get lost in the valleys. My sister's on crack. We only see her between highs and buys. She'd be all nervous and shit, rubbing the back of her hand like it's some kind of magic lamp. So we all stand around and wish all the dope in the world would turn into penny candy. Cause my sister got a sweet tooth, and mama swears she'll pull it out before she give her up to sugar. Thank you. This is a poem that tries to talk about what happened at my grandmother's funeral. But it requires you to not only listen, but to participate by the end of it. This is a response poem, so if you're listening, you'll know what to do at the very end. And I don't know if any of you have been to a Catholic funeral before. Anybody? Okay. Well, it's different from a traditional Baptist or Pentecostal or stomped-down primitive Baptist, Southern Baptist, you know, in the amount of emotion invested in the service, the amount of excitement that happens. In a Pentecostal funeral, people might run down the aisle, might jump on the casket, might pass out. There's a whole lot of singing. The minister's going to preach for as long as he has to, because somebody's got to come down front and get saved. You know, he's not going to stop until somebody comes down. A Catholic funeral is nothing like that. It's very quiet. It's very organized. Starts on time, you know, and ends on time. This is what happened at my grandmother's Catholic funeral. I thought you said this was the Lord's house. I don't feel nothing here. All these Southern Baptists and no outbursts. Something's wrong. No real tears, just quiet, respectful, organized sobbing. We don't need this priest. We need a church with ministers and a congregation to moan and wail, to open up heaven's door so wide that a chariot is coming to take this black woman home. Make some noise, damn it. Stop that nice, passive Latin chanting. Ain't this a funeral? Ain't that about somebody's mother lying there? Find us one of those Aretha, Mahalia, Shirley, Caesar, Jackson voices to reach deep inside and rip out all of this sorrow. Somebody scream, please. Somebody get up and fight the devil for this soul. Put some old black fingers on that organ and let them make it swing so low. We fall out in the aisle screaming, take me to Jesus. She wasn't all good, but she was all ours, and we don't just give each other up all nice and polite like. It ain't our way. It ain't never been, not this family. And if this is the Lord's house, well, he still must be asleep, because there's too many nappy heads in here for this to be a quiet Catholic church. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
All right. All right, y'all listening. One of the things I have to deal with, because I travel a lot outside the state of Kentucky, is that people have a hard time believing that black people live here. Okay? Now, I go to college campuses in Idaho and Montana and Oregon, and people with degrees look me right in the eye and say, you know, are there other black people in Kentucky? And that used to bother me until I realized that they've never been to Kentucky. Everything they know about Kentucky has something to do with Kentucky Fried Chicken or the Kentucky Derby or what they see on television. You know, they've seen Dukes of Hazzard, they've seen Beverly Hillbillies, they've seen Deliverance, they seen Next of Kin, and they think that's Kentucky, you know. So they're always shocked to find out that, you know, they would think this is the Bronx or Harlem or Atlanta or D.C. or Cleveland, that this couldn't possibly happen in Kentucky. So this is my response when they make that statement. Now I want you to listen and see how many of the names in this poem you recognize that are part of Kentucky's history. If you're a true Kentucky history scholar, and I think there may be only one in the room, Dr. Hart, you might miss half of these names, but he'll get them all. Kentuck, once bloody ground, hunting Eden for native tongues, apologetically eliminating buffalo for sustenance, not sport or profit or pleasure. Uncommon wealth, repopulated with immigrants and freedmen who discovered black lung was as indiscriminate as calluses and hunger. You remain north and south, interstate highways, your crucifix, blessing yourself with 64 and I-75. You have derbied and dribbled yourself a place in a world that would not let you forget. You corrupted basketball. Your cash crop causes cancer, and the run for the roses, it's only 2 minutes long. Kentucky, beautiful ugly cousin, I too am of these hills. My folks have cornrowed tobacco, laid track, strip mine, worshiping whiskey from Harlem to Maysville, old Dunbar to Central. Our Whitney Youngs and May Street kids cut their teeth on bourbon balls. And though conspicuously absent from Millionaire's Row, we have Isaac Murphy our way down the backstretch. Cassius Clay, our names in cement. We are the amen in Churchill Downs, the mint in the julep. We put the heat in the hot brown and gave it color. Indeed, some of the bluegrass is black. Thank you. So do black people live in Kentucky? Yes. Most certainly, right? Let me switch gears to, this is a, feels pretty on time. This is my, I guess, most recent collection. And some of these poems are old, but they're still about the same thing. I'm still writing about family and place and identity, social justice issues. One of the things that I continue to write about, and even when I think they're about me or somebody else, they seem to still be about my mother or what my mother tried to teach us. Let me read a poem that connects me to her. It's called Enough. I remember tying up dirty clothes in bed sheets to be transported to the laundromat across town in a yellow cab. I remember large block letters on plain white boxes and cans and discovering that USDA peanut butter was not as smooth or creamy as a neighbor's Jif. Before free lunch and food stamps, we could leave school at noon to eat. Sometimes we would split a fried egg sandwich. Sometimes we'd have a long walk home. Summers were spent under the bed, shirtless and reading, stuck to the cool tile floor. Government housing didn't come with air conditioning. I remember quietly disappearing and running home and away from the sound of the ice cream man before we learned to pour red Kool-Aid into ice tray popsicle treats. Other kids always had more house, more toys, more food, more daddies. But Mama said we were rich because we always had enough. Thank you. And this collection opens up with about 20 poems that are basically childhood memories. And I think that those of you who are young writers, if you think you have nothing to write about, however old you are, think about how far back you can remember. Most people can remember 3, 4, 5 years old. Some people swear they can remember being one. That always scares me when people say that. You know. But however many years you can remember, that's how many years worth of memory you have to use to pull from as reference points to write. And speaking of years, who owns a pair of Air Jordans? Anybody? How many years have they been making Air Jordans? Does anybody know? Last year was the 20th anniversary of Air Jordans. I know a couple of people who have at least 20 pairs. They try to get one every year. Here's a tribute poem. Called Jump Man. And you guys weren't alive when they made the first commercial. In the first commercial, Spike Lee appeared as one of his characters from She's Gotta Have It. He was Mars Blackman with a big gold Mars Blackman chain on. And he refers to Michael Jordan as money in those commercials, and sometimes he reappears in the remakes. But in the very first commercial, he appeared. And the poem opens with a reference to that. So, Jumpman. Mars Blackman was wrong. It was never just the shoes, never just the box of assembled in Asia, artificial fabric and rubber hype with insoles. With the same passion, others collected model trains, rookie cards, and comic books. We have coveted your shoeboxes, stacked them in our closets like bars of gold. For 20 frantic seasons of Final Fours, we've adorned our backs with Carolina blue, named our sons Jordan, desired to deserve to wear number 23 just like you. Shiny and black, tongue wagging, fingers splayed, you stopped hiding your long limbs, unfolded yourself, heart full of nothing but air, tested the breeze, then took off from the free throw line, eclipsing my father's floating, stinging butterfly, leaving the ground indefinitely with such ease, defying gravity, achieving that now emblematic mid-air wingless form, an icon etched into our minds, souls, and wallets. From hard dirt courts in Kentucky to lakeshore concrete playgrounds, we knew the secret to your power was something real as our hopes and dreams, something familiar, something we could touch. Now we know it was never just the shoes. You remained head and shoulders above the fray because you were standing on Satchel Paige, Jack Johnson, Arthur Ashe, Althea Gibson, Wilma Rudolph, Bill Russell, and Jim Brown. All this time, you were standing on us. Thank you. Now that particular poem about a famous sports athlete was supposed to be flattering. This next one is a little more critical and full of hidden meaning. Even if you don't know anything about golf, you might appreciate this. It's called Teed Off. He hugs his father, but won't embrace himself for fear of distancing sponsors, seeking someone safe to parade around private plantations with rolling greens and whites only signs. Carnivorous feline or just another big game prized, poached and coached, raised in captivity, trained not to bite the masters. See, not all poems are happy, but hopefully they're about authenticity, they're about whatever is real. And I try to continue to write about real things. There's a whole section in here that deals with growing up in a household where my mother was a Pentecostal minister for 22 years. So there are about 8 poems that deal with religion. I'll share one of those before moving on to one of the other collections. But one more chicken joke in the clubhouse might make him ignore his home training, forget his marketing strategy, become another 600-pound white tiger in Vegas, smiling at the camera, green jacket shreds stuck in his teeth. All right, a couple more from here, and we'll move to the last collection. Get you guys some air conditioning. You guys know who Gwendolyn Brooks is? Some of you, I see some nods. If you don't know Gwendolyn Brooks, when you go back to class, particularly if you're still in high school, demand that your English teacher share some Gwendolyn Brooks with you. She's mostly famous for one poem, although she wrote hundreds of them. She was the first black woman to win the Pulitzer Prize. So she's really important to American literature in general. Her really famous poem called We Real Cool goes like this. We real cool, we skip school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we thin gin, we sing sin, we jazz June, we die soon. Now the problem with that may be the language is a little bit outdated. So I've updated it for you. This is my version of her poem called We Real Crunk. Okay. Thought you might recognize that word. And it's saying the same thing. So just listen. We real crunk. We real crunk. We buy junk. We walk slow. Wear pants low. We sling rocks. Run from cops. We get laid. Die from AIDS. Thank you for appreciating that. That's it. I always tell when you're listening. All right, I'm going to share one more poem from this section. And I want to share it because it's a family poem. And I want you to be able to appreciate what I think is more aptly called the air conditioning power of a poem. If you're really listening, hopefully you will feel this poem. And this is my response to friends and relatives sharing with me the fact that they've been diagnosed with cancer. And the thing about that sharing, even though it continues to happen as recent as last year, there's never an appropriate response to anybody who shares that personal tragedy with you. So this is kind of a reference to that. When you pause, when you hear that news and you don't know what to say, there's a vacuum, there's a hollow space. This is called Hollow. That's from my Aunt Minnie, who passed from leukemia. What do you say when a loved one brings death home for dinner and introduces her like a lesbian lover, an interracial romance, or some other traditionally unwelcome guest that might become more palatable by dessert after 20 questions and forced but polite conversation? How do you pretend that the sight of post-chemo hollowness and a pillowcase full of hair is normal as you fight not to stare, search the ceiling tiles and search the ceiling tiles and carpet for lighthearted icebreakers and beg your own eyes to lie? What do you say? You say, I love you. You say your prayers. And you swallow every good bye real slow. Hopefully you felt that. That when poetry is doing its best work, you not only hear it, you can feel it. And part of my job as a poet is to try to identify what it is I'm feeling when I'm writing a certain poem and try to find the right words for you to experience it in the same way. That when you read it off the page, that if I'm angry and the poem is angry, you can feel that. You know, if I'm sad in the same way, that you can feel that. And again, I said it last night, poetry is meant to be read out loud, you know. So even if you've been assigned some poetry to read, read it to yourself out loud. It totally will change your experience of it. I'm going to close with a handful of poems from this historical collection. And it's going to sound a little different because I hope you believe that it's not me reading anymore, that this is in the voice of York. York was the slave who traveled on the Lewis and Clark expedition. He was owned by William Clark. You've all studied Lewis and Clark probably in middle school, but you probably never heard of York. You probably didn't know that he was considered big medicine by Native Americans. Big medicine is a reference for the supernatural. You know, they thought he was powerful. They thought he was magical. They wanted to keep him with them. They wanted to rub the black off of him to see if he was real. They put him in a sweat lodge and tried to sweat the black off of him. But they were so amazed at his power and agility. There are still tribes in the Northwest who are proud of their connection with York. I'm going to tell parts of his story because this collection tries to tell his entire life story before the expedition, during the expedition, and after the expedition. I only have time to share pieces of that, but I want to share enough for you to hear his voice, to try to get a sense of how he may have felt being part of the expedition, and being doubly oppressed because he had a chance to feel like he experienced freedom for 3 years, but he was still a slave when he returned. And at the same time, he experienced some things that are quite magnificent. I hope all of you, if you haven't, have the opportunity to travel to the northwest part of this country. You think we have hills or mountains here. Imagine if in the summertime the mountain you can see from out your front door in July still has snow at the top. That's a mountain. You know, we don't really have mountains in Kentucky. We think there are because it's all relative, but that landscape is awesome. So imagine being a slave for 32 years, having a chance to travel across the country and see the ocean for the first time. Imagine if the biggest fish you ever saw was a catfish and suddenly you see a whale in the ocean. Imagine how that might feel. Imagine trying to describe how big it was when, you know, you can't say it was big as a Camry because you've never seen a Camry, not 1803. What would you say? Big as a what?
Covered wagon,
that's good. He might say that. Or in this case, he says, big as a cabin. I'm trying to explain how big this thing is. He'd never seen anything like this. The other thing I want you to hear is there'll be references in what I'm going to read. There's a reference to Old York. Old York is Young York's father because slaves didn't have last names. To separate them, they called them Young York and Old York so you can know who the father and the son was. York was married. His wife was owned by a different family in Louisville, Kentucky. You guys finished? You finished? Okay, I'll continue. And it's important that when you hear those references, you understand what that means. But again, this is in York's voice, so I'm just going to read them straight through. Don't respond in between. About 10 in a row, just so you hear his voice. Wind talker. If I could make my words dress their naked selves in blackberry juice, lay down on a piece of bark, sheep, or onion skin like massa do, if I could send a letter home to my wife, floated in the wind on wings or water, I'd tell her about Katanka and all the wide and high places this side of the big river, how his family, numbering three for every star in the sky, look like a force when they graze together, turn into the muddy Missouri when they thunder along faster than any horse, making the grass lay down long after the quiet has returned. How they don't so much as raise a tail when I come around with my woolly head and tobacco skin. Like I'm one of them, making the Arikara and Mandan think me big medicine, Katanka who walk like man. Today, we stood on the edge of all this, looked out at so much water, the mountains we crossed to get here seem a little smaller. As I watch fish the size of cabins dance in the air and splash back in the water like children playing, I think about her and if we gon' ever be free. Then I close my eyes and pray that I don't live long enough to see Massa make this ugly too. God's house. When we first left Kentucky, the trees had commenced to dressing up the fall harvest, and the garden was already full of pumpkins and squash. Master Clark didn't ask me to go on no expedition. He just said pack and pointed to the dough. So I gather up what little I got, and more than I carry his, and head off to a sail-bearing keelboat where his friend, Master Lewis, is waiting. That boat was so big you could lay any 10 of the 16 men on board or 8 of me head to toe and still have enough room for the dog. We start out on the Ohio and swing up the Old Manor rivers. When we gets to the mouth of the dark woman that calls the Big Muddy, we sets up winter camp a good canoe ride from St. Louis. That spring, when the rains come, we cross the Mississippi and commence to climb in the Missouri and float right up through heaven on earth. More sky than I ever seen, rocks as pretty as trees, and game so plentiful they comes right down to the riverbank and invites theyselves to dinner. Now, I ain't what you would call a scripture quoter, but the first time I seen the waterfall at Missouri, felt a herd of buffalo stampede and looked down from the top of Rock Mountains, it was like church. And where else but God's house can a body servant big as me carry a rifle, hatchet, and a bone-handled knife so sharp it can peel the black off a lump of coal? And the white man still close his eyes and feel safe at night. Primer. The only book we allowed to know is the Bible. Though many a slave been sold south, had fingers chopped off and worse for the crime of reading and writing. I figures my respect for a good telling come from listening to old York weave his magic at night. Folk hung from our porch like baby possums and lived off the breath he give to every story, no matter how many times they tasted the tale. I learned to appreciate the power of single words holding the lamp over Master Clark while he studied his brother's letters and struggled with his own returns. Them think all slaves dumb because we can't cipher, but they'd be surprised how many words we pick up just standing around like trees in a room full of educated men. Sundays and Christmas. I cares plenty for my wife, but I've been told a slave can't truly know love, being as massa and white men's in general have and takes certain privileges with our women. I suspect the deepest hurt in the world be to risk being tied to a woman's hearth, then standing on the front porch while the massa part her thighs, knowing that any cry raised is inviting death or worse. But what else but love make you hold that woman even tighter, try to rock her back to whole long after the tears dry up and the hurt turns the ashes back to flames? It being nighttime and deep into winter, I can think of no other breath I wish to feel and no other whisper I ache to hear. What we allowed to feel might not rate as love, but it'd be powerful enough to make you rue the time between visits. I'm going to skip about 40 poems all the way to the end, just so you can get a sense of how things end. The thing about the expedition that's important is that York felt like he earned his freedom because of his participation. When he returned, that's not exactly what happened. When we set foot back in Old St. Louis, there was much celebration and putting on as everyone had given us up for dead. We paraded through the streets, firing our guns, and made a home in the nearest tavern. No one seemed to tire hearing us tell our stories night after night. After many cups and tellers, there came tales of herds of grizzlies, big talking fish, and Indian women 10 foot tall. The truth seemed to stretch so that by and by, I seemed to disappear from their tongues, as if I had never even been there. As if my blackness never saved their hides. Them twist the tails and leave out my parts in it so much so that directly I become Master Clark's boy again, just along to cook and carry. Just rewards. I rode and walked as much and carried more than any man on the expedition. When we returned, Master Clark got acres of land, lots of pay, and grand balls in his honor. I got a short week in Kentucky to say goodbye to my wife before returning to his new home in St. Louis. Unable to fill my emptiness with whiskey, I earned many lashes at his hands for being what he calls insolent and sulky, or what I calls speaking up for my freedom. I'm going to close with this one. I think it does a fair job. It's not the last poem, but it allows him to get the last word. It's called Cumulonimbus. What I come to know is no man born a slave, serving another for life, agreeing to be treated like cows and pigs and less, be something a slave weigh every day after he look at his other choices, death and running. Slaving ain't no picnic. We might look happy, but us grin mostly to keep from crying. Old York say it takes something African to stand in the rain and smile while it's storming all around. He say nobody choose to slave. Them choose to hold on to what little family them got. Them choose to be sure somebody's still here to tell our side, to tell the whole truth when it all said and done. What some calls lightning and thunder, just be God trying to see what we choosing and us grumbling about being slaves. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
In your first book that you read out of, the woman there just said something like a microwave, maybe. Can you tell me what that is?
What is? The poem or the reference?
It says, like, my name, microwave, maybe. What is a microwave?
Let me try to find that poem for you. I'm sorry?
Page 17.
Oh, y'all been talking about this in class.
No, okay. Me and him been talking about it all.
All right, no, it's not on page 17 then. I'll look it up. That poem is about language, Neapolitan. Okay, is the name of the poem. It's on page 27, so you're close. That poem is about how young people, how fast you move. All right, now, those of us who are older than you, when we cook something, it's probably going to be in an oven. It's probably going to take at least an hour. Your generation microwaves everything because you want it now, okay? That's what that means, that delayed gratification doesn't exist. You know, you got to have yours now. So anything, when you use microwave as an adjective, it means you want it now. You're not willing to wait. So that's my response. Good question. Thank you. Other questions, comments? Yes, sir.
What advice would you give to your younger readers who may get lost in some of the symbolism? What advice would you give them maybe of how they can understand it?
Well, there are two things that you can ask older people or ask people who know. And there's a really useful tool that just came out 4 months ago. It's called the Urban Dictionary. My daughter loves it. Every word you think you just made up yesterday is in this dictionary already, along with the definitions. And for you teachers who feel like there are conversations happening in another language in your classrooms, get you an Urban Dictionary, and you can. It may help close that gap. Okay, they say don't do it. But I think more importantly than looking up yourself is having those conversations. One of the things we don't do well anymore is have intergenerational exchange, particularly conversations. You know, you should not just be limited to your peer group conversation-wise. You should be talking to the oldest people in your family. You should be asking them to tell you things about what they remember being kids, because they won't be with you always. And you're going to wish that you either wrote that down or you remember exactly what they said or you had that recorded. With all this technology, you should record an interview. Everybody in here should record an interview with the oldest relative you have and then save that for your grandchildren. Imagine if you had a recording of your great-grandfather talking to your great-great-grandmother. Imagine how valuable that would be to you. So imagine you have the power to leave that kind of legacy right now. But of course, you can't think about it like a microwave. You know, that's a delayed kind of gratification. The payoff is several generations away. But please consider that as an option. I mean, it's so valuable. Thank you for that question. Other questions, comments? Yes, ma'am.
What's your process of writing?
I'm sorry. I'll get you next. I'm sorry?
What is your process of writing like?
I'm a morning person as far as when I write. I feel the most alive, the most awake, the most creative. This may scare you at 4:30 in the morning. But it has more to do with the fact that I'm asleep at 10 o'clock. And I probably sleep at 10 o'clock because I got up at 4:30. And once you get on that cycle, it's hard to break that cycle. The thing about needing to get up at 4:30 in my house is that, you know, I'm 44 years old, and most of those years I've never lived by myself. There's always been somebody else in that house. And being one of 10 kids, you know, you learn to treasure quietness. And you can't, writing is something you have to do in isolation, so you need a quiet space. So that's when it happens for me. My process is to honor that first creative impulse, to try to capture down what I'm feeling, what the thought was, if I'm trying to remember a person, an event, tell a story. That's only the easy part of it. After that, craft starts. I'm a committed editor. Everything in a book probably has had at least 20 revisions. Even if I just change a period or a comma or a line break or the title, because the poem is so short, it has to work like a novel, but you only have this much space to do it. So every single word, every single line break, everything has to be intentional and not wasted. Or you're cheating yourself, you're cheating a reader. The biggest thing I do is have a broad definition of what writing is. To me, writing is the process, which means that reading is part of my process. Sometimes I don't feel like writing anything. I don't feel creative, so I read, and I consider that still writing because it's part of the process. Observing, listen to how people talk, because if you write fiction, you're going to have to recreate authentic dialogue. You need to make it, if it's an old person talking to a young person, you don't need to tell me it's an old person talking to a young person. I need to be able to figure it out because of what they say to each other. And its authenticity will jump off the page. And you can only know what's authentic if you experience the real world as it is, if you listen. And unfortunately for you, authenticity is not something you get from television. Most of what's on television is artificial. Authenticity is in the real world. Follow somebody around, eavesdrop on a conversation, and you'll hear something different from what you may hear on television. You know, the thing about TV that made me realize when it was unrealistic is my son asked me one day, he said, "So why don't people on TV and in the movies ever go to the bathroom?" I'd never thought about that. You know, he's paying attention that closely, and that's just an indication of how truncated that experience is. They have this artificial existence. But if you're writing, you know, a real story about somebody who's drinking 10 Coca-Colas a day, and then your short story that never goes to the bathroom, somebody's going to ask that question, you know, what kind of kidneys do they have, you know? Is their bladder bigger than their lung? You know, what's going on in the story? But authenticity is what you're striving for. And communication, I think writing is about communication, and the communication isn't finished until somebody reads it. So you could write it all day long in the privacy of your room, and it could just be therapy, but once somebody reads it and responds to it, you've completed that transaction. That's my short answer to the process. What was your question?
Oh, I kind of answered my question.
Okay, you don't have one anymore? You said kind of answers it, so.
It did.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Thank you for reading for us. It's great to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I'm teaching a class right now called Kentucky Literature, and the students will be reading Buffalo Dance. And so in Buffalo Dance, you're channeling York's voice. Another book I considered for this class was Davis McComb's Ultima Thule, and I think in that collection, he channels kind of the voice of Stephen Bishop, and yet your voice, York's voice, is much different than McComb's dealing with Stephen Bishop, who was a black man who explored Mammoth Cave.
Mm-hmm.
And McComb's is a white fella. And I just wondered, what do you think about somebody who's Caucasian trying to write from the perspective of, like Stephen Bishop?
Well, I think it's a simple issue. If you're committed to authenticity, it doesn't make any difference, you know. But if the commitment's not there, it may show. You know, a lot of people criticize that particular collection by suggesting it doesn't ring true in some cases. It doesn't sound like it's a black man talking. So you have to do something to lessen that distance between you and that person you're trying to make us believe is real. There's a Stephen Bishop poem in here. It's a tribute to his contribution to Mammoth Cave. But in general, you know, I think that if you're looking for authenticity, a better book, even better than Buffalo Dance, is a collection called Lead Belly, the blues musician. And not only do you hear Lead Belly's voice in that, you know, this is a collection that won the National Poetry Series contest. Tehinbi Jess wrote that. It's available through Amazon.com. I use it as a textbook when I teach in the summer. And also Marilyn Nelson's poems called Carver, which is about George Washington Carver. Both of those collections, unlike Buffalo Dance, which is just York's voice, both of those collections have at least five different people speaking, and they speak more than once. So you get a conversation, and you get kind of a cross-reference on the same things, which I think is very useful in those cases. So if you're looking for that authenticity, if you're looking for the true voice, add those as examples and explore them as, you know, I think you'll love reading them, period. If you like music, if you like Lead Belly, if you don't know that story, his character is amazing, and that book really brings it all to life. It's a powerful collection. I highly recommend it. Questions, comments? You guys all right? Still hot in. Anybody change their attitude about poetry? No? That was quick. Kick him out, take him out. Drag him out, hang him in the backyard.
I was just wondering if you read the poet of the poetry of AI, African American woman, and each one of the poems is in a different voice. You know, she I think she creates a different character each time.
I had her as an instructor once. She did a visiting stint at University of Kentucky when I was an undergrad a million years ago. So yes, I have a lot of respect for her work. Other comments? Anybody in the back? Yes.
I really enjoyed We Were Come. What made you decide
to update it? She said she liked We Were Come. Why did I update it? Well, very simply, I shared We Were Cool with a group of students in Cincinnati, 10th graders, and they didn't like it. I was shocked that not only did they not like it, they couldn't appreciate it. And they made me feel like it was because the language was out of, you know. But it was important to me to try to recreate that, because the thing about it is such a powerful message. And it sounds like you guys got it. I mean, her poem ends with, you know, we die soon. And there's something very final and somber about, you know, the reality of that, and it is an urban reality. If you consider what's happening in urban areas, she was just trying to say that. And unfortunately, you know, that was a little more than 45 years ago, but not that much has changed. You know, that reality still exists. So I had to write the same poem, but just change the language. And if you have a chance to compare the two, everything about it is the same. It's still four couplets. It's still one-syllable words. The same structure exists. And I really want to be true to that. And it even says, after Gwendolyn Brooks. I don't want to steal from her. It's a tribute poem to her. And it's meant to be taught together. And I think it's a great exercise in the classroom to consider not just those two poems, but think about, you know, what other ways can you update language or an old idea, you know. Because you guys do it every day. You know, the genius happening in the world is happening in your age group. You know, you guys, because you are microwaves, you know, new language, new clothing styles, new music. I mean, I'm amazed and humbled. And keep doing it. But write it down, record it, you know, use it, understand it. Because you'll laugh at yourselves when you open your high school journal or annual when you're 50 years old and see what you said and what you were writing and what people said to you. Your children will laugh at you. But right now, I know it all seems implausible. Now that I'm encouraged to go have children. Don't hold off as long as you can. But record what's happening now. You know, think of yourself as a time capsule. It'll be very valuable to you one day, I promise. Last chance for questions. You remember, you got another one, huh?
Do you use a lot of life experiences in your work?
No, I make it all up. Yes, but I don't say my poetry is autobiographical. I steal from the real world. It's important to me that it's believable. If you think it happened, that's good enough for me. Because it's not a biography. It's not an autobiography. It's a poem, and most poems are meant to create a picture, tell a story, recreate a mood. And if they do that, then I'm successful. You know, I settle for that. Yes, ma'am?
Growing up in Danville and Dan Black, was it like hard? Because I've been there before, and I never knew black people to live there. So I've been on the campus of Center and
Governor Scholars? Wait, Governor's, okay.
My cousin went to
Okay. Was it hard growing up in Danville? I guess no harder than Bowling Green.
No, we're from Franklin.
From where?
Franklin.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah.
Oh, that's even better. So what's the percentage of African Americans in Franklin?
We have a high percentage of African Americans per capita.
Okay.
Yeah, like fourth in state, maybe.
Okay. All right. Well, it's like opposite of what you would experience. But actually, the thing about the reality is, growing up in Danville really prepared me for what my adult life would be like, because I've worked in predominantly white institutions for the last 30 years. If I had grown up in Danville, I probably had a hard time. I know a lot of students who came from Atlanta and D.C. To University of Kentucky and had culture shock because they weren't used to not having everybody in their classroom look just like them. I know people who come from other counties in Kentucky I had a student say to me once that, you know, she sat in the front row, and every time I walked toward her, she would almost tremble, you know. And finally, she admitted in a conference that she'd never been in a room with a black man before, that she'd never had a black teacher. There were black people in her town, her church, her school. And she probably believed all the things that television said was going to happen, you know, when I walked up. You know, I was either going to rob her, you know, attack her, steal her money, try to take her home and date her, you know, all the stereotypes. So she was genuinely afraid. That was the first week of school. So, you know, so I think one of the things that we're able to do in these diverse environments is allow people to experience us as individuals. So she went home to her county and said, you know what, you know, all black men aren't like that thing on the television, you know. I know at least one that is intellectually alive, that is a teacher of all things, and they were going, no! But I happen to come to Franklin, the fourth in the state. Well, if you know about the rest of the state, that's easy to do, though. That's not really a compliment. It just says a lot about this state. But I'm so happy you guys are here, and thank you, teachers, for bringing these wonderful students. You may not realize it, but you are a perfect audience. You know, well attentive. I hope that you listen. I hope you got something from this. I hope you don't feel like it was a waste of your time. I hope that you remember at least one poem or one thing that happened here today that is worth telling somebody else. If nothing else, read some poetry that looks like you. Thank you.